His moustaches began to move with some energy, and I could only imagine the grimaces they concealed.
Poirot, he has been a fool. A contemptible fool, to allow this to happen.
Poirot, no one could possibly accuse you of... I began.
No, do not try to console me. Always you want to turn away from pain and suffering, but I am not like you, Catchpool. I cannot countenance such cowardice. I want to regret what I regret without you trying to stop me. It is necessary.
I stood still as a statue. He had wanted to silence me, and he had succeeded.
Catchpool,
he said my name abruptly, as if he thought my attention might have wandered far from the matter at hand.
Observe the marks made by the blood here.
The body was pulled through it to leave this trail. Does that make sense to you? He demanded.
Well, yes, I'd say so.
Look at the direction of movement. Not towards the window, but away from it.
Which means what?
I asked. Since Jenny's body is not here, it must have been removed from the room. The trail of blood is going not towards the window, but towards the corridor. So!
Poirot stared at me expectantly.
So, I said tentatively. Then, as clarity dawned,
oh, I see what you mean. The marks, the smears, were made when the killer pulled Jenny Hobbs's body from the pool of blood towards the door?
No. Look at the width of the doorway, Catchpool. Look at it. It is wide. What does this tell you?
Not an awful lot, I said, thinking it best to be candid. A murderer wishing to remove his victim's body from a hotel room would hardly care whether the doorway of that room was wide or narrow.
Poirot shook his head disconsolately, muttering under his breath. He turned to Lazzari.
Signor, please tell me everything you know from the beginning.
Of course, certainly.
Lazzari cleared his throat in preparation.
A room was taken by a woman named Jenny Hobbs, Monsieur Poirot. She ran into the hotel as if a calamity had befallen her, and threw money down on the desk. She requested a room, as if escaping from a pursuing demon. I showed her to the room myself, and then went away to commence the consideration. What ought I to do? Should I inform the police that the woman with the name Jenny has arrived at the hotel? You had asked me about that name in particular, Monsieur Poirot, but there must be many women in London with the name Jenny, and more than one of those Jennies must have a cause for great unhappiness. That is nothing to do with the murder case. How am I to know if...
Please, Signor, arrive at the point, said Poirot, interrupting his flow. What did you do?
I waited about 30 minutes, then came up here to the fourth floor and knocked at the door. No answer. So I went back downstairs to get a key.
As Lazzari spoke, I walked over to the window and looked out. Anything was preferable to the sight of the blood and the hat and the wretched monogrammed cufflink. Room 402, like Richard Negus's room 238, was on the garden side of the hotel. I stared at the pleached limes, but soon had to look away, as even they looked sinister to me. A row of inanimate objects fused together, as if they had held hands for too long. I was about to turn back to Poirot and Lazzari, when I spotted two people in the garden beneath the window. They stood beside a brown wheelbarrow. I could only see the tops of their heads. One was a man and the other a woman, and they were locked together in an embrace. The woman seemed to stumble or slump, her head tilting to one side. Her companion grasped her more tightly. I took a step back, but I was not fast enough. The man had looked up and seen me. It was Thomas Brignall, the assistant clerk. His face instantly turned beetroot red. I took another step back so that I could no longer see the gardens at all. Poor Brignall, I thought. Given his reluctance to stand up and speak in public, I could well imagine how painfully embarrassed he must be to be caught canoodling. Lazari continued with his account.
When I returned with the master key, I knocked again to make sure I was not about to intrude upon the young lady's privacy, and still she did not open the door. So I unlocked it myself. And this is what I found.
Did Jenny Hobbs specifically request a room on the fourth floor? I asked.
No, she did not. I assisted her myself, since my dear, trusty clerk, John Good, was otherwise occupied. Miss Hobbs said, put me in any room, but quickly, quickly, I beg of you.
Was any sort of note left at the front desk to announce the fourth murder? Asked Poirot.
No, this time there was not the note, said Lazari.
Were any food or beverages served to the room or requested?
No, none.
You have checked with everybody who works in the hotel?
Every single person, yes, Monsieur Poirot, we have looked everywhere.
Signor, a few moments ago you described Jenny Hobbs as a young lady. How old was she, would you say?
Oh, I must beg your pardon. No, she was not young, but she was not old.
Was she perhaps 30? Poirot asked.
I believe she might have been 40, but a woman's age is a difficult thing to estimate.
Poirot nodded. A brown hat and a pale brown coat. Fair hair. Panic and distress, and an age that might be 40. The Jenny Hobbs you describe sounds like the Jenny Hobbs I encountered at Pleasant's Coffee House last Thursday evening. But can we say for certain that it was she? Two sightings, by two different people.
Suddenly he fell silent, though his mouth continued to move.
Poirot? I said.
He had eyes, intensely green eyes, at that precise moment, only for Lazari.
Signor, I must speak to that most observant waiter again, Mr. Raphael Bobek, and Thomas Sprignell, and John Good. In fact, I must speak to every single member of your staff as soon as possible and ask how many times they each saw Harriet Sippel, Richard Nikus, and Ida Gronsberry, dead or alive.
He had evidently realized something important. As I reached this conclusion, I heard myself gasp as I, too, made a mental leap.
Poirot, I murmured. What is it, my friend? You have put some pieces of our puzzle together?
Poirot, he understands now something that did not strike him before. But there are still questions. Still pieces that cannot be made to fit.
I have... I cleared my throat. Speaking, for some reason, was proving rather difficult. I have just seen a woman in the hotel gardens. I could not, at that moment, bring myself to say that she had been in the arms of Thomas Brignall, or to describe the strange way in which she had seemed to crumple, her head falling to one side. It was simply too peculiar. The suspicion running through my mind was one I would have felt embarrassed to utter aloud. Thankfully, however, I did feel able to divulge one important detail.
She was wearing a pale brown coat, I told Poirot.
Chapter 16. A Lie for a Lie. I was engrossed in my crossword puzzle when Poirot returned from the hotel to the lodging house several hours later.
Catchpool, he said severely. Why do you sit in almost total darkness? I do not believe you can see to write.
The fire provides enough light. Besides, I'm not writing at the moment. I'm thinking. Not that it's getting me very far. I don't know how these chaps do it, the ones who invent crosswords for the newspapers. I've been working on this one for months, and I still can't get it to fit together. I say, you might be able to help. Can you think of a word that means death and has six letters?
Catchpool.
Now Poirot's tone was even sterner. Hmm? I said.
Do you take me to be the fool? Or is it that you are a fool yourself?
A word for death that has six letters is murder.
Yes, is that one's rather obvious. That was my first thought.
I am relieved to hear it, mon ami.
That would be perfect if murder began with a D. Since it doesn't, and since I'm stuck with a D from another word, I shook my head in consternation.
Forget crossword puzzles, we have much to discuss.
I don't believe, and won't believe, that Thomas Brignall murdered Jenny Hobbs, I said firmly.
You feel sympathy for him? Said Poirot.
I do, and I would also bet my last penny that he is no murderer. Who's to say that he doesn't have a girlfriend with a pale brown coat? Brown is a popular colour for coats.
He is the assistant clerk, said Poirot.
Why would he stand in the gardens beside a wheelbarrow?
Perhaps the wheelbarrow was simply there.
And Mr. Brignall stands with his lady friend right beside it?
Well, why not? I said, exasperated. Isn't that more plausible than the idea that Brignall took Jenny Hobbs's dead body out to the gardens with a plan to wheel it off somewhere in a wheelbarrow, then pretended to embrace her when he saw me looking out of the window? One might just as well say...
I stopped and inhaled sharply.
Oh, goodness, I said.
You are going to say it, aren't you?
What, mon ami, what do you think Poirot will say?
Raphael Bobak is a waiter, so why was he pushing a laundry cart?
Exactement. And why does he push the laundry through the elegant lobby in the direction of the front doors? Is the laundry not washed inside the hotel?
Signor Lazari, you would surely have noticed this if he had not been so concerned about the missing fourth murder victim.
Of course, he would not be suspicious of Mr. Bobak. All of his staff are beyond reproach in his eyes.
Wait a second. I finally laid down my crossword on the table beside me. That was what you meant about the width of the doorway, wasn't it? That laundry cart could easily have been pushed into room 402, so why not wheel it all the way in? Why drag the body instead, which would take more effort?
Poirot nodded with satisfaction.
Indeed, mon ami, these are the questions I hoped you might ask yourself.
But are you honestly saying that Raphael Bobak might have murdered Jenny Hobbs, thrown her body in with the laundry, and pushed it out onto the street right past us? He stopped to talk to us, for pity's sake.
Indeed, even though he has nothing to say.
What is it? You think I am uncharitable, thinking the bad thoughts about those who have been so helpful to us?
Well, giving everybody the benefit of the doubt is laudable, my friend, but it is no way to apprehend a murderer.
While you are displeased with me, let me put one more thought into your head. Mr. Henry Negus, he had with him a very large suitcase, did he not? Large enough to contain the body of a slender woman.
I covered my face with my hands. I can't bear much more of this, I said.
Henry Negus.
No, I'm sorry, but no. He was in Devon on the night of the murders. He struck me as absolutely trustworthy.
You mean that both he and his wife say that he was in Devon?
Poirot briskly corrected me.
To return to the matter of the trail of blood, suggesting that the body had been dragged to the door.
Of course, an empty suitcase can be carried into the middle of a room to where a dead body waits to be placed inside it.
So, again, we must wonder, why pull Jenny Hobbs's body in the direction of the door?
Please, Poirot, if we must have this conversation, let us have it some other time, not now. He looked put out by my discomfort.
Very well,
he said brusquely. "Since you are in no mood to debate the possibilities, let me tell you what occurred here in London while you were in Great Holling. Perhaps you will feel more comfortable with facts."
"A great deal more comfortable, yes," I said. After making minor adjustments to his moustaches, Poirot lowered himself into an armchair and launched into an account of the conversations he'd had with Raphael Bobach, Samuel Kidd, Nancy Duquesne, and Louisa Wallace while I was in Great Holling. My mind was reeling by the time he had finished. I risked urging him on to further loquacity by saying, "Haven't you left out some rather important things?"
"Such as what?"
"Well, this useless, clumsy maid at Louisa Wallace's house, Dorcas, you implied that while you and she were standing together on the upstairs landing, you realized something important, but you didn't say what it was that you realized."
"That is true. I did not."
"And this mysterious picture you drew and had delivered to Scotland Yard, what's that all about? What was the picture of? And what is Stanley Beer supposed to do with it?"
"That also I did not tell you."
Poirot had the nerve to look apologetic, as if he had himself had no choice in the matter. Foolishly, I persisted. "And why did you want to know how many times each and every Bloxham Hotel employee saw Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, and Richard Negus alive or dead? How is that pertinent to anything? You didn't explain that either."
"Poirot, he leaves the gaps all over the place."
"Not to forget your earlier omissions. What, for instance, were the two most unusual features shared by the Bloxham murders and Jenny Hobbs's outburst in Pleasance Coffee House? You said they had two highly unusual things in common."
"Indeed I did.
Mon ami, I do not tell you these things because
I want to make of you a detective."
"This case will make nothing of me but a miserable wretch of no use to anyone," I said, allowing my true feelings to have an outing for once in my life. "It's the most maddening thing." I heard a noise that might or might not have been a knock at the drawing-room door. "Is somebody there?" I called out.
"Yes,"
came Blanche Unsworth's apprehensive voice from the hall.
"I'm sorry to disturb you at this time, gentlemen, but there's a lady to see Mr. Poirot. She says it can't wait."
"Show her in, madame."
A few seconds later, I found myself face to face with the artist Nancy Duquesne. Most men, I knew, would have thought her startlingly beautiful. Poirot made the introductions with perfect courtesy.
"Thank you for seeing me."
Nancy Duquesne's swollen eyes suggested that she had done a fair amount of crying. She was wearing a dark green coat that looked expensive.
"I feel dreadful barging in on you like this. Please pardon the intrusion. I tried to persuade myself not to come, but, as you can see, I failed."
"Please sit down, Mrs. Duquesne," said Poirot.
"How did you find us?"
"With help from Scotland Yard, like a proper bona fide detective."
Nancy attempted a smile.
"Ah, Poirot, he chooses a house where he thinks no one will find him, and the police send the crowds to the door.
No matter, madame. I am delighted to see you, if a little surprised."
"I would like to tell you what happened in Great Holling 16 years ago," said Nancy. "I should have done so before, but you gave me such a shock when you mentioned all those names I had hoped never to hear again."
She unbuttoned her coat and took it off. I gestured towards an armchair. She sat down.
"It's not a happy tale," she said.
Nancy Duquesne spoke in a quiet voice and with a haunted look in her eyes. She told us the same story that Margaret Ernst had told me in Great Holling, about the cruel and slanderous treatment of Reverend Patrick Ive. When she spoke of Jenny Hobbs, her voice shook.
"She was the worst of them. She was in love with Patrick, you see. Oh, I can't prove it, but I shall always believe it. She did what she did to him as someone who loved him. Told an unforgivable lie because she was jealous.
He was in love with me, and she wanted to wound him, to punish him. Then when Harriet seized on the lie, and Jenny saw the harm she had done and felt sick about it, and I do believe she felt dreadfully ashamed and must have hated herself, she did nothing to remedy what she had set in motion, nothing. She slunk off into the shadows and hoped not to be noticed. However afraid she was of Harriet, she should have forced herself to stand up and say, "I told a terrible lie, and I'm sorry for it."
"Pardon, madame. You say you cannot prove that Jenny was in love with Patrick Ive. May I ask, how do you know that she was? As you suggest, it is unthinkable that one who loved him would start so damaging a rumor."
"There is no doubt in my mind that Jenny loved Patrick," said Nancy stubbornly. "She left behind a sweetheart in Cambridge when she moved to Great Holling with Patrick and Francis. Did you know that?"
We shook our heads.
"They were supposed to get married. The date was set, I believe, and Jenny couldn't bear to let Patrick go. So she cancelled her wedding and went with him."
"Could it not have been Francis Ive to whom she was so attached?"
Poirot asked.
"Or to both of the Ives. It might have been loyalty and not romantic love that she felt."
"I don't believe many women would put loyalty to their employers above their own marriage prospects, do you?"
said Nancy.
"Assuredly not, madame. But what you tell me does not quite fit. If Jenny were inclined towards jealousy, why was she moved to tell this terrible lie only when Patrick Ive fell in love with you? Why did his marriage to Frances Ive, long before then, not provoke her envy?"
"How do you know that it did not? Patrick lived in Cambridge when he and Frances met and married. Jenny Hobbs was his servant then, too. Perhaps she whispered something malicious about him in a friend's ear, and that friend, not being Harriet Sipple, chose to spread the malice no further."
Poirot nodded.
"You are right. It is a possibility."
"Most people prefer not to spread ill will, and thank goodness for that," said Nancy. "Perhaps in Cambridge there is nobody as malevolent as the person Harriet Sipple turned into, and nobody as eager as Ida Gransbury to lead a pious moral crusade."
"I notice you do not mention Richard Negus."
Nancy looked troubled. "Richard was a good man. He came to regret his contribution to the whole awful business. Oh, he regretted it deeply once he understood that Jenny had told a despicable lie, and once he saw Ida for the pitiless creature she was. He wrote to me a few years ago from Devon to say that the matter had been preying on his mind. 'Patrick and I were quite wrong to conduct ourselves as we did,' he said, 'and he would never change his mind about that. Marriage vows were marriage vows. But he had come to believe that punishment was not always the right path to follow, even when one knows that an offence has taken place.'"
"That is what he wrote to you?"
Poirot raised his eyebrows.
"Yes. I expect you disagree."
"These affairs are complicated, madame."
"What if, in punishing somebody for the sin of falling in love with the wrong person, one only brings greater sin into the world? And more evil. 2 deaths. One of a person who has committed no sin."
"Oui. This is precisely the sort of dilemma that creates the complication."
"In his letter to me, Richard wrote that, Christian as he was, he could not bring himself to believe that God would wish him to persecute a sweet-natured man like Patrick."
"Punishment and persecution are 2 separate things," said Poirot. "There is also the question, has a rule or law been broken? Falling in love. Enfin, we cannot help how we feel, but we can choose whether or not to act upon those feelings. If a crime has been committed, one must ensure that the criminal is dealt with by the law in an appropriate fashion, but always without
personal venom and spite, always without the lust for vengeance, which contaminates everything and is indeed evil.
Lust for vengeance, Nancy Duquesne repeated with a shudder. That was it exactly. Harriet Sipple was filled with it. It was sickening.
And yet, in telling the story, you have not once spoken angrily of Harriet Sipple, I said. You describe her behaviour as sickening, as if it saddens you. You do not seem angry with her, as you are with Jenny Hobbs.
I suppose that's true, Nancy sighed. I used to be devoted to Harriet. When my husband William and I moved to Great Holling, Harriet and George Sipple were our dearest friends. Then George died, and Harriet became a monster. But once you have been very fond of a person, it's difficult to condemn them, don't you find?
It is either impossible or irresistible, said Poirot.
Impossible, I should say. You imagine that their worst behaviour is a symptom of an ailment and not their true self. I couldn't forgive Harriet's treatment of Patrick. I couldn't persuade myself to try. At the same time, I felt that it must have been as horrible for her as it was for anybody else to have turned into that.
You saw her as a victim?
Of the tragedy of losing a beloved husband, yes. And so young. One can be both victim and villain, I think.
It was something that you and Harriet had in common, said Poirot.
The loss of a husband when you were far too young.
This will sound heartless, but there is really no comparison, said Nancy. George Sipple was everything to Harriet, her whole world. I married William because he was wise and safe, and I needed to escape from the home of my father.
Ah, yes, sir. Albinus Johnson, said Poirot. It came back to me after I left your house that I do indeed know the name. Your father was one of a circle of English and Russian agitators in London at the end of the last century. He spent a period of time in jail.
He was a dangerous man, said Nancy. I couldn't bear to speak to him about his ideas, but I know that he believed it was acceptable to murder any number of people if those people were delaying the cause of making the world a better place. Better only according to his definition. How, in the name of heaven, can anything ever be made better by bloodshed and mass slaughter? How can any improvement be brought about by men who wish only to smash and destroy, who cannot speak of their hopes and dreams without their faces twisting in hatred and anger?
I agree with you absolutely, madame. A movement driven by fury and resentment will not change any of our lives for the better.
Ce n'est pas possible.
It is corrupt at the source.
I nearly said that I too agreed, but I stopped myself. Nobody was interested in my ideas. Nancy said,
When I met William Duquesne, I did not fall in love with him, but I liked him. I respected him. He was calm and courteous. He never behaved or spoke intemperately. If he failed to return a book to the library when it was due to be returned, he would suffer agonies of remorse.
A man with a conscience.
Yes, and a sense of proportion and humility. If something stood in his way, he would consider moving himself before he would consider moving the obstacle. I knew that he would not fill our home with men intent on making the world uglier with their violent acts. William appreciated art and beautiful things. He was like me in that respect.
I understand, madame, but you did not love William Duquesne passionately, in the way that Harriet Sipple loved her husband.
No. No, the man I loved passionately was Patrick Ive. From the first moment I saw him, my heart belonged to him alone. I would have laid down my life for him. When I lost him, I finally understood how Harriet had felt when she had lost George. One thinks one can imagine, but one can't.
I remember thinking Harriet morbid when she begged me, after George's funeral, to pray for her death, so that she might be quickly reunited with him. I refused to do as she asked. The passing of time would ease her pain, I told her, and one day she would find something else to live for. Nancy stopped to compose herself before continuing. Regrettably, she did. She found a delight in the suffering of others. Harriet, the widow, was a joyless harridan. That was the woman who was killed at the Bloxham Hotel in London recently. The Harriet I knew and loved died with her husband George. She looked at me suddenly. You observe that I am angry with Jenny. I have no right to be. I am as guilty as she is of letting Patrick down. Nancy started to cry and covered her face with her hands. Come, come, madame, here. Poirot passed her a handkerchief. How did you let down Patrick Ive? You have told us that you would have sacrificed your life for him. I am as bad as Jenny, a disgusting coward. When I stood up in the King's Head Inn and confessed that Patrick and I were in love and had been meeting in secret, I did not tell the truth. Oh, the secret meetings were real enough, and Patrick and I were desperately in love. That was true, too. But Nancy appeared too distressed to continue. Her shoulders shook as she wept into the handkerchief. I think I comprehend, madame. That day at the King's Head Inn, you told the villagers that your relations with Patrick Ive had been chased. That was your lie. Poirot, he guesses correctly? Nancy let out a wail of despair.
I couldn't bear the rumours, she sobbed. All those whispered, macabre tales of encounters with the souls of the dead in exchange for money. Little children hissing in the street about blasphemy. I was appalled. You cannot imagine the horror of so many voices of accusation and condemnation all rounding on one man, a good man.
I could imagine. I could imagine it so vividly that I wished she would stop talking about it.
I had to do something, Monsieur Poirot. So I thought, I shall fight these lies with something pure and good, the truth. The truth was my love for Patrick and his for me, but I was afraid. And I tarnished our truth with lies. That was my mistake. In my frenzy, I could not think clearly. I sullied the beauty of my love for Patrick with faint-hearted dishonesty. Relations between us were not chaste, but I said that they were. I imagined that I had no choice but to lie. That was craven of me. Despicable.
You are hard on yourself, said Poirot. Unnecessarily so. Nancy dabbed at her eyes.
How I wish I could believe you, she said. Why did I not tell the whole truth? My defense of Patrick against those horrible accusations should have been a noble thing, and I ruined it. For that I curse myself every day of my life. Those braying, spittle-flecked sin-hunters at the King's Head, they all disapproved of me anyway. Thought I was a fallen woman, and Patrick the very devil. What would it have mattered if they had disapproved a little more? In point of fact, I'm not sure there was a higher peak of opprobrium for them to ascend to.
Why, then, did you not tell the truth? Poirot asked.
I hoped to make the ordeal more bearable for Francis, I suppose, to avoid a bigger scandal. But then Francis and Patrick took their own lives, and all hope for ever making anything better was lost. I know they killed themselves, whatever anybody says,
Nancy added as an apparent afterthought. Is this a fact that has been disputed? Asked Poirot.
According to the doctor and all official records, their deaths were accidental. But nobody in Great Holling believed that. Suicide is a sin in the eyes of the church. The village doctor wanted to protect Patrick and Francis's reputations from greater damage, I think. He liked them very much, and stood up for them when no one else would. He's a good egg, Dr. Flowerday, one of very few in Great Holling. He knew a wicked lie when he heard one.
Nancy laughed through her tears.
A lie for a lie and a tooth for a tooth.
Or a truth for a truth, Poirot suggested.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Nancy looked surprised.
Oh, dear. I've quite ruined your handkerchief.
It is not important. I have others. There is one more question I should like to ask you, madame. Is the name Samuel Kidd familiar to you?
No. Should it be?
He did not live in Great Holling when you lived there?
No, he did not. Lucky old him, whoever he is, said Nancy, bitterly.
Chapter 17. The Older Woman and the Younger Man.
So, said Poirot once our visitor had left us and we were alone.
Nancy Duquesne agrees with Margaret Ernst that the Ives committed suicide. But the official record is of two accidental deaths. Ambrose Flowerday told this lie in order to protect the reputations of Patrick and Francis Ive from further damage.
How extraordinary, I said. Margaret Ernst said nothing about that.
I wonder, then, if we have found the reason why she made you promise not to speak to the doctor. What if Ambrose Flowerday is proud of the lie he told? Proud enough, maybe, to confess, if asked. If Margaret Ernst wished to protect him.
Yes, I agreed. That could have been the reason she wanted to steer me away from him.
The desire to protect. This I understand only too well.
Poirot's voice was fierce with emotion.
You mustn't blame yourself about Jenny, Poirot. You could not have protected her.
There, you have the wisdom, Catchpole. Protecting Jenny would have been impossible for anyone, even Hercule Poirot. It was too late to save her even before I met her. This I now understand. Much, much too late.
He sighed.
It is interesting, is it not, that this time there is blood, where before there was poison and no blood.
What I keep wondering is, where is Jenny's body? The bloxham has been searched from top to bottom and nothing.
Do not ask yourself where, Catchpole. Where does not matter. Ask yourself why. Whether the body was removed from the hotel by laundry cart, suitcase, or wheelbarrow, why was it removed? Why was it not left in the hotel room as the other three were?
Well, what's the answer? You know what it is, so tell me.
Indeed, said Poirot. All of this can be explained, but I am afraid it is not a happy explanation.
Happy or not, I'd like to hear it.
In the fullness of time, you will hear everything. For now, I will tell you this. No employee of the Bloxham Hotel saw either Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, or Richard Negus more than once, apart from one man, Thomas Brignell. He saw Richard Negus twice, once when Negus arrived at the hotel on the Wednesday, and Brignell attended to him, and again on Thursday evening, when he bumped into Mr. Negus in the corridor, and Mr. Negus asked him for a sherry.
Poirot gave a self-satisfied little chuckle.
Reflect upon that, Catchpole. Do you start to see what is suggested by that fact?
No.
Ah!
For pity's sake, Poirot! Never had one syllable, ah, been enunciated in such an infuriating fashion.
I have told you, my friend, do not expect always to be given the answer.
I'm well and truly stumped. From several angles, it looks as if Nancy Duquesne must be our killer, but she has an alibi from Lady Louisa Wallace. So, Who else might want to kill Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransbury, Richard Negus, and now Jenny Hobbs, too? I stamped up and down the drawing room, angry with myself because I couldn't see a way out of the bind. And though I still think you're crazy to suspect them, if the murderer is Henry Negus or Raphael Bobak or Thomas Brignall, what could the motive have been? What connection do any of those people have to the tragic events in Great Holling 16 years ago? Henry Negus has the oldest and most common motive in the world. Money. He told us, did he not, that his brother Richard had been squandering his wealth. He told us also that his wife would on no account banish Richard from her home. If Richard Negus dies, Henry Negus does not have to pay for his upkeep. If Richard does not die, he might end up costing his brother a small fortune. And Harriet Sipple and Ida Gransbury, Jenny Hobbs? Why would Henry Negus kill them, too? I do not know, though I could speculate, said Poirot. As for Raphael Bobak and Thomas Brignall, I can think of no possible motive for either man unless one of them is not who he purports to be. I suppose we could do a bit of digging around, I said. While we are compiling a list of possible suspects, what about Margaret Ernst and Dr. Ambrose Flowerday? Poirot suggested. They were not in love with Patrick Ive, but they might nevertheless have been motivated by the desire to avenge him. Margaret Ernst was, by her own account, sitting in her house alone on the night of the murders. And we do not know where Dr. Flowerday was because you promised you would not seek him out, and, alas, you kept your promise. Poirot will have to go to Great Holling himself. I did say that you ought to come with me, I reminded him. But I suppose if you had, you wouldn't have been able to talk to Nancy Duquesne and Raphael Bobak and the others. Incidentally, this younger man and older woman that Bobak overheard Harriet Ida and Richard Negus talking about, assuming we believe his account, I've been pondering, and I've even made a list of all the romantically linked couples I can think of. I produced the list from my pocket. I will admit that I was hoping to impress Poirot, but either he wasn't impressed or else he hid it well. George and Harriet Sipple, I read aloud. Patrick and Francis Ive, Patrick Ive and Nancy Duquesne, William Duquesne and Nancy Duquesne, Charles and Margaret Ernst, Richard Negus and Ida Gransbury. In none of these pairings is the woman older than the man, certainly not by enough to be described as old enough to be his mother. "Tch," said Poirot impatiently. "You do not think, my friend. How do you know that this couple exists with the older woman and the younger man?" I stared at him, wondering if he had lost his reason. "Well, Walter Stokely talked about them at the King's Head, and Raphael Bobak overheard—" "No, no," Poirot interrupted gracelessly. "You do not pay attention to the details. In the King's Head Inn, Walter Stokely spoke of a woman putting an end to her romantic involvement with the man, did he not? Whereas the conversation that Raphael Bobak overheard between the three murder victims was about a man no longer romantically interested in a woman who still craved his love. How can these be the same people, the same couple? The very opposite must be true. They cannot possibly be the same people." "You're right," I said, dejected. "I didn't think of that." "You were too delighted with your pattern, that is why. A much older woman and a much younger man over here, and a much older woman and a much younger man over there. Voila! You assume they must be the same." "Yes, I did. Perhaps I'm in the wrong job." "No, you are perceptive, Catchpool. Not always, but sometimes. You have helped to steer me through the tunnel of confusion. Do you remember when you said that whatever Thomas Brignall was withholding, he was doing so for reasons of personal embarrassment? That was a remark that proved very helpful to me, very helpful indeed. Well, I'm afraid I'm still in the tunnel and can't see a flicker of light at either end.
I will make you a promise, said Poirot. Tomorrow, immediately after breakfast, we will pay a little visit, you and I. After that, you will comprehend more than you do now. I hope that I will also.
I don't suppose I am permitted to ask whom we will be visiting.
You may ask, mon ami.
Poirot smiled.
A telephone to Scotland Yard for the address. It is one you would recognize, I think, if I told it to you.
Which, needless to say, he had no intention of doing.
Chapter 18. Knock and see who comes to the door.
As we made our way across town the following morning to pay our mysterious visit, Poirot's mood was as changeable as the London weather, which could not make up its mind between sunny and cloudy. At one moment he would appear to be pleased with himself and at ease, and the next he would furrow his brow as if worrying away at something. We finally arrived at a modest house on a narrow street.
Number 3, Yarmouth Cottages, said Poirot, standing outside it.
From where do you know this address, Catchpole? It is familiar to you, no?
Yes. Hold on a moment. It will come to me.
That's right.
It's Samuel Kidd's address, isn't it?
Indeed.
A helpful witness who saw Nancy Duquesne run from the Bloxham Hotel and drop 2 keys, even though Nancy Duquesne could not have been at the Bloxham Hotel just after 8 o'clock on the night of the murders.
Because she was at Louisa Wallace's house, I agreed.
So we're here to give Mr. Kidd a scare, are we? And find out who put him up to lying?
No. Mr. Kidd is not at home today. He has gone to work, I expect.
Then let us play a little game called Knock and See Who Comes to the Door, said Poirot with an enigmatic smile.
Go ahead. I would knock myself if it were not for my gloves, and I do not wish to make them dirty.
I knocked and waited, wondering why Poirot expected anyone to come to the door of a house whose only known occupant was elsewhere. I opened my mouth to ask him, then closed it again. There was, of course, no point. Wistfully, I remembered a time, less than a fortnight ago, when I believed that asking a straight question of someone who knew the answer was a worthwhile thing to do. The front door of number 3 Yarmouth Cottages opened, and I found myself looking into the large eyes of a person who was not Samuel Kidd. At first, I was puzzled, for this was a face I did not know. And then I watched, as terror twisted the features, and I knew who it had to be.
"Good morning, Mademoiselle Jenny," said Poirot.
"Catchpole, this is Jenny Hobbs, and this, mademoiselle, is my friend Mr. Edward Catchpole. You might remember that we talked about him at Pleasant's Coffee House.
Allow me to express my profound relief at finding you alive."
That was when I knew for sure that I knew nothing. The few paltry scraps of certainty upon which I had been relying had proved themselves untrustworthy. How the deuce had Poirot known he would find Jenny Hobbs here? It was simply impossible. And yet, here we were. After Jenny had composed herself and arranged her expression into something less abject and more guarded, she invited us into the house and bade us wait in a small, dark room with shabby furniture. She then excused herself, saying that she would be back shortly.
"You said it was too late to save her," I said angrily to Poirot. "You lied to me."
He shook his head.
"How did I know that I would find her here? It is thanks to you, mon ami. Again, you help Poirot."
"How?"
"I invite you to think back to your conversation with Walter Stockley at the King's Head Inn to what he said about a woman who could have had a husband, children, a home of her own, and a happy life. Do you recall?
What about it?
A woman who devoted her life to a substantial man, who sacrificed everything for him? Then later Mr. Stokely said she couldn't marry some kid, not once she had fallen in love with a man of substance. So she left him behind. You remember telling me this, mon ami?
Of course I do. I'm not an imbecile.
You thought that you had found our older woman and much younger man, n'est-ce pas? Raphael Bobak had referred to them at the Bloxham Hotel. He told us that the three murder victims were talking about them. And you thought Walter Stokely had in mind the same couple. So you asked Mr. Stokely how much older this woman was than the man whose love she had spurned. Because you believed that you heard him say she couldn't marry some kid. But, my friend, you did not hear him say this.
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact.
No. What you heard him say was, she couldn't marry Sam Kidd. Mr. Samuel Kidd.
But... Oh, dash it all.
You leapt to an incorrect conclusion because Walter Stokely had already used the word kid more than once. The young man with whom he had been drinking he had called a kid. Eh bien, your error was one that many in your position would have made. Do not chastise yourself too severely.
And then, having misunderstood, I asked Stokely about the difference in age between the woman who could have married but didn't and the ne'er-do-well he had been drinking with before I arrived. He must have wondered why I wanted to know, when Jenny Hobbs had nothing to do with the ne'er-do-well.
Oui, this he might have asked you, had he not been stupefied by alcohol.
Ah, well, Poirot shrugged.
So Jenny Hobbs was engaged to Samuel Kidd, I said, trying to take it all in.
And she left him behind in Cambridge in order to come to Great Holling with Patrick Ive.
Poirot nodded his agreement. Fee Spring, the waitress from Pleasance, she told me that Jenny suffered a heartbreak in her past. I wonder what it was.
Haven't we just answered that question? I said. It must have been leaving Samuel Kidd behind.
I think it is more likely to have been the death of Patrick Ive,
the man Jenny truly loved.
Incidentally, I am certain that this is why she altered her way of speaking,
to sound more like someone of his class, in the hope that he might see her as an equal and not merely as a servant.
Are you not afraid that she might disappear on you again? I asked, looking towards the closed door of the sitting room.
What is she doing that's taking so long?
You know, we ought to take her straight to a hospital if she hasn't already been.
A hospital?
Poirot looked surprised.
Yes, she lost a fair amount of blood in that hotel room.
You assume too much, said Poirot.
He looked as if he had considerably more to say, but at that moment Jenny opened the door.
Please forgive me, Monsieur Poirot, she said.
For what, mademoiselle?
Silence of an uncomfortable sort filled the room. I wanted to speak and put an end to it, but doubted my ability to contribute anything useful.
Nancy Duquesne, Poirot said very slowly and deliberately. Was she the person from whom you fled when you sought refuge in Pleasant Coffee House? Was she the one you feared?
I know she killed Harriet, Ida, and Richard at the Bloxham Hotel, Jenny whispered. I've read about it in the papers.
Since we find you in the home of Samuel Kidd, your former fiancé, can we assume that Mr. Kidd has told you what he saw on the night of the murders? Jenny nodded.
Nancy, running from the Bloxham. She dropped two keys on the pavement, he said.
It is a coincidence. Incroyable, mademoiselle. Nancy Duquesne, who has murdered 3 people already and wishes to murder you also, is seen running from the scene of her crimes by none other than the man you once intended to marry?
Jenny uttered an almost inaudible,
yes.
Poirot, he is suspicious of a coincidence so large.
You are lying now, and you are lying when we last met.
No, I swear.
Why did you take a room at the Bloxham Hotel, knowing it was where Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Nikos had met their deaths? You have no answer for that, I see.
Allow me to speak, and I shall answer. I was tired of running. It seemed easier to have it over with.
Is that so? You calmly accepted the fate that awaited you? You embraced it and moved toward it?
Yes.
Then why? To Mr. Lazari, the hotel manager, why did you ask him to provide you with a room quickly, quickly, as if you are still in flight from your pursuer? And, since you do not appear to be wounded, whose was the blood in room 402?
Jenny began to cry, swaying slightly on her feet.
Poirot rose and helped her to a chair. He said,
"Sit, mademoiselle. It is my turn to stand. And to tell you how I know beyond doubt that nothing you have ever said to me has been the truth."
"Steady on, Poirot," I cautioned him. Jenny looked as if she might faint.
Poirot seemed unconcerned.
"The murders of Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus were announced in a note," he said. "May they never rest in peace. 121-238-317. Now I wonder to myself, a killer who walks in a state of brazen calm to a hotel's front desk and places a note there advertising 3 murders. Is this the sort of person who would then panic, run from the hotel panting, and drop 2 room keys in front of a witness? Are we to believe that the killer Nancy Duquesne's panic commenced only after she had left the note on the desk? Why would it start only then? And if Nancy Duquesne was making her exit from the Bloxham at shortly after 8 o'clock, how could she also be dining with our friend Lady Louisa Wallace at the very same moment?
Poirot, don't you think you ought to go easy on her?
I do not. I ask you, Mademoiselle Jenny, why should Nancy Duquesne leave a note at all? Why did the 3 dead bodies need to be found shortly after 8 o'clock that evening? The hotel maids would have found them in due course. What was the hurry? And if Madame Duquesne was calm and composed enough to approach the desk and leave the note without arousing suspicion, that must mean she was able to think sensibly about what needed to be done. Why, then, did she not also put the 2 room keys safely in her deep coat pocket at that point, before she left the hotel? Foolishly, she keeps them in her hand and then drops them in front of Mr. Kidd. He is able to see they have numbers on them, 100 and something and 300 and something. He also, by fortunate coincidence, happens to recognize the face of this mysterious woman. And after a short pretense of being unable to recall her name, he is most conveniently able to tell us the name of Nancy Duquesne. Does all of this sound plausible to you, Miss Hobbs?
It does not sound at all plausible to Hercule Poirot. Not when he finds you here in Mr. Kidd's home, and he knows that Nancy Duquesne has an alibi.
Jenny was weeping into her sleeve.
Poirot turned to me.
Samuel Kidd's testimony was a lie from start to finish, Catchpole. He and Jenny Hobbs conspired to frame Nancy Duquesne for the murders of Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus.
You don't know how wrong you are,
Jenny cried.
I know that you are a liar, mademoiselle. I have suspected all along that my encounter with you at Pleasance was connected to the Bloxham Hotel murders. The 2 happenings, if we can classify 3 murders as 1 happening,
has two very important and most unusual features in common. That made me sit up straight. I had been waiting to hear these points of likeness for too long. Poirot went on. One, a psychological similarity. In both cases, there is the suggestion that the victims are guiltier than the murderer. The note left on the desk at the Bloxham, "May they never rest in peace," suggests that Harriet Sipple, Ida Gronsberry, and Richard Negus deserved to die, and that their killer brought them to justice. And at the coffee house, Mademoiselle Jenny, you said to me that you deserved to die, and that once you had been killed, justice would have been done finally.
He was right. How had I missed that?
Then there is the second similarity, which is not psychological, but circumstantial. Attached to both the Bloxham Hotel murders and my conversation with the frightened Jenny at the coffee house, there were too many clues. Too much information available too soon. Too many leads presenting themselves all at once, almost as if someone wanted to offer the hand of help to the police. From a brief meeting in a coffee house, I was able to glean a surprisingly large number of facts. This Jenny, she felt guilty. She had done something terrible. She did not want her killer to be punished. She made sure to say to me, "Oh, please let no one open their mouths." So that when I hear about these three bodies at the Bloxham Hotel with cufflinks in their mouths, I will perhaps remember what she has said and wonder. Or perhaps my subconscious will make the connection.
"You're wrong about me, Monsieur Poirot,"
Jenny protested. Poirot ignored her and continued with his speech. "Let us now consider the Bloxham Hotel murders. There again, we found ourselves supplied with much information suspiciously soon. Richard Negus paid for all three rooms and for the cars from the railway station to the hotel. All three victims lived or had lived in the village of Great Holling. There was, in addition, the helpful clue of the initials P.I.J. on the cufflinks, to direct us to the reason these three people needed to be punished, that is, for their callous treatment of Reverend Patrick Ive. Furthermore, the note left on the front desk made it clear that the motive was revenge or a thirst for justice. It is rare, is it not, for a murderer to write down his or her motive and, so helpfully, leave it lying in a prominent place?
Actually, some murderers do wish their motive to be known, I said.
Mon ami,
said Poirot with exaggerated patience, if Nancy Duquesne had desired to kill Harriet Sipple, Ida Gronsberry, and Richard Negus, would she really have done so in a way that led so clearly back to her? Does she wish to go to the gallows? And why did Richard Negus, who according to his brother was on the verge of penury, pay for everything? Nancy Duquesne is a rich woman. If she is a murderer who enticed her victims to London in order to kill them, why did she not pay for their hotel rooms and transport? None of it fits together.
Please let me speak, Monsieur Poirot. I will tell you the truth.
I prefer, for the time being, that I tell you the truth, mademoiselle.
Forgive me, but I find myself to be more reliable.
Before you told me your story, you asked me if I was retired, did you not? You made a great show of checking that I had no powers to arrest anybody or enforce the law in this country. Only then, once I had reassured you in this point, did you confide in me. But I had already told you that I had a friend in Scotland Yard. You spoke to me, not because you believed me to be powerless to arrest a murderer, but because you knew perfectly well that I had influence with the police, because you wished to see Nancy Duquesne framed and hanged for murder.
I wished no such thing.
Jenny turned her tear-streaked face to me.
Please, stop him.
I will stop when I am ready, said Poirot. You are a regular visitor to Pleasance Coffee House, mademoiselle. The waitresses have said so. They talk about their customers a great deal in their absence. I expect you heard them speak about me, the fussy European gentleman with the moustaches who used to be a policeman on the continent, and my friend Catchpool here from Scotland Yard. You heard them say that I dine at Pleasance every Thursday evening at 7:30 precisely. Oh, yes, mademoiselle. You knew where to find me, and you knew that Hercule Poirot would be perfect for your devious purposes. You arrived at the coffee house in an apparent state of terror, but it was all a lie, an act. You stared out of the window for a long time, as if fearful of someone in pursuit, but you cannot have seen anything out of that window except the reflection of the room that you were in. And one of the waitresses, she saw your eyes reflected and saw that you were watching her, not the street. You were calculating, were you not? Will anyone suspect that I am feigning my state of distress? Will that sharp-eyed waitress guess the truth and prevent my plan from being successful? I rose to my feet.
Poirot, I don't doubt that you're right, but you can't simply go on at the poor woman without allowing her to say a word in her defense. Be quiet, Catchpool. Have I not just explained to you that Miss Hobbs is excellent at creating an appearance of great unhappiness while underneath her true self is composed and calculating?
You are a cold-hearted man,
Jenny wailed. Au contraire, mademoiselle. In due course you will have your turn to speak. You may rest assured. But first, I have another question for you. You said to me, oh, please let no one open their mouths. How did you know that Nancy Duquesne, after killing her three victims, had placed cufflinks in their mouths? It seems to me odd that you should know this. Did Mrs. Duquesne threaten that it would happen? I can imagine a murderer threatening violence in order to scare. If I catch you, I will cut your throat, or something of that nature. But I cannot imagine a killer saying, after I have murdered you, I intend to place a monogrammed cufflink in your mouth. I cannot imagine any person saying that, and I am a man of considerable imagination. And, pardon me, one final observation, mademoiselle. Whatever guilt was yours for the tragic fate of Patrick and Francis Ives, three people were as guilty as you, if not more so. Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Nikos. They were the people who believed your lie and turned the whole village against the Reverend Ive and his wife. Now, at Pleasance, you said to me, once I am dead, justice will have been done, finally. And you placed the stress upon the I, once I am dead. This indicates to me that you knew that Harriet Sipple, Ida Gransberry, and Richard Negus were already dead. But if I look at all the evidence as it has been presented to me, the three murders at the Bloxham Hotel might not yet have been committed.
Stop! Please, stop!
Jenny wept. In a moment, with pleasure. Let me only say that it was approximately 7:45 when you spoke those words to me. Once I am dead, justice will have been done, finally. And yet we know that the three Bloxham murders were only discovered by the hotel staff after 8:10. Yet somehow you, Jenny Hobbs, had advanced knowledge of these murders. How?
If only you will stop accusing me, I shall tell you everything. I've been so desperate, having to keep it all secret and lie constantly. It was a torment. I can't bear it any longer.
Bon, said Poirot quietly. He sounded suddenly kinder. You have had a severe shock today, have you not? Perhaps you will now see that you cannot deceive Poirot.
I do see. Let me tell you the story from the beginning. It will be such a relief to be able to tell the truth at last.
Jenny spoke at length then, and neither I nor Poirot interrupted her until she indicated that she had finished. What follows is in her words, and is, I hope, a faithful and complete account of what she said. Chapter 19. The Truth at Last.
I destroyed the life of the only man I have ever loved, and I destroyed my own life along with it. I didn't mean for things to take the turn they took. I would never have imagined that a few silly, cruel words spoken by me could lead to such a disaster. I ought to have considered and kept my mouth shut. But I was feeling wounded, and in a moment of weakness I allowed spite to get the better of me. I loved Patrick Ive with every bone and muscle in my body. I tried not to. I was engaged to be married to Sam Kidd when I first started working for Patrick, as his bedder at Saviour College in Cambridge, where he studied. I liked Sam well enough, but my heart belonged to Patrick within a few weeks of first meeting him, and I knew that no amount of trying to feel differently would change that. Patrick was everything good that a person could be. He was fond of me, but to him I was only a servant. Even after I learned to speak like the daughter of a master of a Cambridge college, like Francis Ive, I remained in Patrick's eyes a loyal servant and nothing more. Of course I knew about him and Nancy Duquesne. I overheard some of his conversations with her that I wasn't supposed to. I knew how much he loved her, and I couldn't bear it. I had long ago accepted that he belonged to Francis and not to me. But it was intolerable to discover that he had fallen in love with a woman who was not his wife, and that that woman was not me. For a few fleeting seconds, no longer, I wanted to punish him, to cause him grievous hurt of the kind that he had caused me. So I made up a wicked lie about him, and, God forgive me, I told that lie to Harriet Sipple. It comforted me for as long as I was telling it. The idea that Patrick's whispered words of love for Nancy, words I had overheard more than once, were not his but the late William Duquesne's, conveyed from beyond the grave. Oh, I knew it was nonsense. But when I told Harriet Sipple, for a few seconds it felt true. Then Harriet set to work, saying dreadful, unforgivable things about Patrick all over the village. And Ida and Richard helped her, which I never understood. They must have known what a venomous creature she had become. Everyone in the village knew. How could they turn on Patrick and ally themselves with her? Oh, I know the answer. It was my fault. Richard and Ida knew that the rumour did not come from Harriet in the first place, but from a servant girl who had always been loyal to Patrick and who was seen as having no reason to lie. I saw at once that my jealousy had led me to do a terrible, heinous thing. I witnessed Patrick's suffering and desperately wanted to help him, and Francis, but I didn't see how I could. Harriet had seen Nancy enter and leave the vicarage at night. So had Richard Negus. If I had admitted to lying, I would have had to offer another explanation for Nancy's nocturnal visits to Patrick. And it would not have taken Harriet long to arrive at the correct explanation by her own deductions. The shameful truth is that I am a dreadful coward. People like Richard Negus and Ida Gransbury, they don't mind what other people think of them if they believe that right is on their side. But I do mind. I have always cared about making a good impression. If I had confessed to my lie, I would have been hated by everybody in the village, and rightly so. I'm not a strong person, Monsieur Poirot. I did nothing and said nothing, because I was scared. Then Nancy, horrified by the lie and by people's believing of it, came forward and told the truth. She and Patrick were in love and had been meeting in secret, though nothing of a carnal nature had taken place between them.
Nancy's efforts on